Football Podcast. It's now 2 weeks since we had any actual football to talk about. There are plenty of issues going on off the field, and we've got a great guest with us today to help us plough through it all. He is a 22 times capped Socceroo, a former Asian Champions League winner and Asian Player of the Year. He played in both the old NSL and the A-League, and safe to say, he had to work damned hard for every single break that came his way. It is a pleasure to welcome my old Fox Sports sparring partner in commentary, Sash Rogonofsky. How are you, Sash?
You're not bad, Simon. Yourself?
Yes, we're getting through it all. What are you doing with yourself in self-isolation? Are you still doing your building work?
Yeah, well, funny enough, I'm still on building sites. So we're at the moment, we're still all systems go until we're otherwise advised, I guess, from the government or the powers to be. So, still on the building sites of Melbourne.
Yeah, you were and still are a carpenter. And I know that along with football, you also used to restore old Mustangs and other classic cars. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, well, I haven't got the time to restore them anymore. Family of seven will do that to you, Simon. So just for reference, if you want any hobbies, don't have a lot of children.
and in between all of that, you somehow find time to be a champion dog breeder, and you go all over the world doing shows with your dogs. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, that's tapered down a little bit, but yeah, I did get to compete at a couple of world championships with my dogs, and that's another sort of passion and hobby of mine that I really like. But like I said, the sort of children have taken over all of that stuff now, so there's not so much time for myself.
When we say champion dog breeder and shower of dogs, what is it you actually do when you go overseas and take part in these competitions? Just explain.
Well, it's a global sport. It's called Mondio Ring. It's a protection and obedience sport. So, and the dogs that I breed are for police and military and sniffer dog type of work, detection type of stuff as well. So. It's a bit of a mixture of all that stuff, but something that I've always had a passion for. Started training my first dog when I was 12, so he was the family German Shepherd, and sort of got bitten by that bug, and yeah, sort of had a bit more time once I finished football and thought I might get into that side of things and start training and educating myself a little bit more in that.
You are a man of many interests and talents. It's amazing, really, that you found time to have a professional football career. But we are here to talk about the football. And before we get on to your playing career specifically, where do you sit at the moment with this impasse between the players and the clubs over their payments during this COVID-19 stoppage? What's your take on all that?
It depends. When you look at it overall, you think the clubs need to do it to survive. Is it fair on the players? Probably not. But you know, it's not fair on the rest of the workforce who have lost jobs in this weird time as well. So it's up to the government to step in, I guess, and help out in some aspects. But it just goes to show that, for me, it shows that, you know, the A-League, in particular the league that I coach in as well, that stopped a few weeks before the A-League. They can't survive without that extra money that comes from TV or whatnot. And it just shows how vulnerable our sport is in the country. You see the AFL, they're still, I know that the players took a pay cut, but they're still sort of able to pay and support the league, whereas our clubs and our league bosses aren't able to do that. And that's just because the money involved in the game isn't as good as where it should be, or maybe we're paying too much And we're sort of paying overs for everything at this stage.
A lot of people are saying this little break gives the game a chance to reset. If that's the case, what needs to happen in your opinion? When we come back on the other end of all of this, what does the game look like in your opinion?
It looks like the last few seasons of the NSL with a better TV package. To me, the level, I think we're seeing too many recycled players. I think we're seeing not enough new fresh faces in the league. So it gets boring. You see the same player, you know, you see multiple players that have played for, you know, almost every club in the league. I mean, if for me, when I see that, I tend to think that we're not giving, you know, any of the other talent around any chance to come up. And that's what excites me. I've sort of stepped into the coaching realm now, and that's what excites me. You know, trying to bring in young players into the training sessions, you know, debuting some young players. And I think we're not seeing enough of that in the A-League, and therefore it doesn't excite the fans to see the same faces roll out year after year. They want to see, you know, the Arzanis. They want to see these type of players that bring excitement to the league on top of any of the marquees that we bring. But I think when teams and clubs nurture their own and then they bring that excitement to the field and it's a player that's come through the ranks and it's a player that's been given an opportunity to play at the highest level, I think that brings a bit more excitement than the rest.
Okay, let's talk about how you came through the ranks. Take us back to where it all started, your Macedonian heritage, of course. Mm-hmm. Is that where your love for the game came from?
Yeah, look, we always loved the football. We followed Preston Lions, now Preston Macedonia, back in the old NSL, and we wouldn't miss any games. I played for that club from seven all the way to seniors. I debuted there as a 15-year-old in the old Victorian Premier League, which is the NPL now. So I remember running onto the ground in the old NSL days. Warren Spink and Oscar Crino and all these guys that played for that club. And it's the only club sort of that I truly follow and I truly love. So, you know, everybody's got a club overseas or whatever, but the only club really that has anything, you know, that I really truly love is Preston. And I guess when you spend your whole life at a club, that's what happens.
And I know that a lot of sons and daughters' love for football comes from their parents. I know you were very close to your father, who's no longer with us. I think you used to celebrate your goals by giving him a little tribute with a point to the sky. Is that your earliest memory of going down to Preston Lions with your dad and watching games?
Yeah, it was. Dad was the one man cheer squad at the club, and then I used to stand there with the rest of the cheer squad. So, it was religion for us. Our Sundays didn't consist of anything else except going to watch Preston.
So after you left Preston Lions, you got the chance to go to the Melbourne Knights in 2000. How did that come about? And do you remember your debut, which I think was at Suncorp Stadium, strangely enough, against the Brisbane Strikers?
Yeah, it was. Vlado Vanish had coached me at Preston, and then he moved on to Melbourne Knights in the NSL, and he got me across to from Preston to Melbourne Knights, and yeah, the debut was against the old, I think, Brisbane Strikers, and we ended up winning that game 2-1. We had a really young, he assembled a really young team, so it was really, I think it's the only team that I've ever played in that the whole team were mates. There was no, you know, proper friends. Like, you could go out with any of them, and you could have a coffee with any of them, and you could talk to any of them. It was a real super team in that way, and we all fought for each other on the field.
And just running through one or two of those names that you played alongside: Roddy Vargas, Joel Porter, Ivan Zelic, brother of Ned, of course, and a bit later, Steve Horvat, Krešimir Marasic, and Andrew Marth, who was also your coach at one stage, Stabber Marth.
Yeah. So they came after Carlton folded. So they came across. It was Horvat, Marth, Daniel Vasilevsky, and Lubo Lipshinsky.
What was Andrew Marth like to play alongside and also to be coached by? Was he as fearsome as his reputation?
Oh, well, as a coach, he was more sort of happy-go-lucky. He wouldn't really, the session so-so, not as structured, sort of more relaxed type sessions. A lot of one-on-one games and stuff like that. But not so much structure as I had, I guess, after him. But yeah, he used to more coach on the field with his direction, directing traffic on field, and you know, he's way as he played as a captain. He was always a skipper because of that, because he could talk and get players in the right positions on the field by communication. So that was his strength, I guess.
Now, Krešimir Marasic was before my time in Australia, but I'm told by those people who watched him in the NSL days that he was one of the best ever to grace the old competition. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, as good as any. As good as any that have come. And there were a few before him as well. Obviously, we don't have a lot of footage of the old NSL, but there were some frightening players. And you had Jelko Adzic, who was another really high caliber player that played at the Melbourne Knights. Before him at Sydney Croatia, the old Sydney Croatia, there was Jakov, I think a couple of your colleagues at Fox used to play alongside him as well. And he was a phenomenal footballer. So there were a lot back then as well. Obviously the way that it was broadcast was a lot differently, and the amount of footage that the old NSL received isn't as good as what it is today. But yeah, when you look at those type of players, for sure they would have thrived in this professional A League environment.
You're with Melbourne Knights for two seasons. You lost to Sydney Olympic in the finals in both years, strangely enough. And then you headed to Greece to play for Panahaiki in 2002. Tell us how that came about. I know that was an interesting experience for you, to say the least.
Well, again, Vlad Ivanish, funnily enough, he called me and he said, "Would you be interested in going to Greece? There's a guy whose son plays there and the team's after a centre-half." I said, "Yeah, sure, no worries." Melbourne Knights wanted to sign me. And funny enough, I said, "I'm not signing." I said, "I'm going overseas." I didn't have an agent or anything. Played two seasons with the Melbourne Knights in the NSL. And then I said, "No, I'm going to go overseas." I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I just said, "I'm not signing anywhere. I'm just going overseas." So I went to the travel agent, booked a ticket. They were in a camp in Trent or somewhere in Italy in the mountains. An Italian coach, Vincenzo Guarini, and his assistant was Marco Rossi, who played at Sampdoria. And I think he finished his career in Mexico for Azteca, I think. I booked a plane ticket, and I got to Vienna Airport, and I got a phone call. I was supposed to get picked up from Milan Airport and driven to the training ground, but I got a phone call from someone from the club, and they said, "Look, we can't pick you up from the airport. You're going to have to catch a bus from Milan to Verona and another train to Bologna." So I can't remember the whole route, but it took about 3.5 hours to get there. I had €250 in my pocket, and the taxi rides from the train from the end of the train station line to where I needed to go was 240 euros. So I was left with 10 euros in my pocket. And started training the next day and then signed a four-year deal. So that was exciting until the league stopped because of TV rights and the club went bankrupt. And they said, whoever wants to leave can leave. There's no more money here. So I picked up my stuff and came back home, clipped a nail bag back on, signed for Preston, played the next couple of seasons there, and it was in between the old NSL and the A-League forming, so it was an interesting time for me. Going from that professional environment, training, you know, every day and playing against, you know, some of the stars in Greece, to coming back and nail bag on and playing in the Premier League again, or the VPL.
I think you're only telling half the story there, Sasha. Didn't you have a more interesting journey back home than that? I thought you took one or two stop-offs elsewhere.
Yeah, I went to China. I went to, there were a few you could say stop-offs. I went back to Macedonia and I said, I'll train there with a club called Pobeda. They've come down to Australia as well in tournament, and they wanted to sign me, but they had no money. So I said, I can't live off what you're giving me. So then another opportunity came up to go on a trial in China, and I get there and we're at this. It was like every club goes there for pre-season. Chinese agent is taking me around from. From team to team, me and another guy from the Bundesliga, I can't remember his name. He played second Bundesliga. He was a Ghanaian international. He was involved in the team that played in the Youth World Cup with France with Benigni. I can't remember exactly. And we're looking at each other and we're going, what the hell's going on here? And he's just going to club and, you know, just pretty much asking the coach, do you need a midfielder? Do you need a defender? So we're looking at each other, we're going, oh God, we've got to get out of here. Anyway, one club says, yeah, we're looking for these players. So we start playing. We play a friendly game and we'll start playing. I went up for a set piece, scored a goal, rolled my ankle in the next play, and I just said, I've got to get out of here. This is not for me. I'm not staying here. But I didn't have any money to change my ticket, so the guy that I was with, he said, look, I'll pay for your ticket. Where do you need to go? And he paid, and we both left. So, and then from there, I came home, clipped a nail bag on, and went and played in Preston.
So then the A-League started in 2005, but you couldn't get a gig. I guess you were close to being lost to the game. I even read somewhere that you were pretty close to actually going playing Aussie rules at semi.
Yeah, I did. I had a mate who was playing at Epping, and that was in the Diamond Valley Football League, and they used to pay okay money, but in the end it was I was just getting paid that little bit more to play in the old MPL VPL, sorry, and that's the only reason I stayed on, pretty much. Otherwise, if I'd got the same money or even close, I would have went and played footy. You know, you try so much, and I had a lot of trials earlier on. Even before I went to the Knights, I went on a trial. I was supposed to go to Sturm Graz. I ended up trialing for a club in Croatia that wanted to see. It was all just every time I went over, and I went over several times, all out of my own pocket. It was just messy. And, you know, you try and you try and you get sort of disheartened, and then you try again and you get disheartened, and then you think you're good enough. It doesn't work out. I went and had a trial at Royal Antwerp once as well. There was a centre-half there that they needed to sell to sign me. All the paperwork had gone through. Last minute, fails the medical. I'm back in Australia again. So
just time after time it was happening. And I guess I didn't have just the luxury of an agent, of a good agent, I guess, because when I look at some of the deals that happen quite easily for some of the players that play in the A-League, a lot of it has to do with, you know, having a good agent helping you find those doors and opening doors for you. So unfortunately, I didn't have that, and I always had to do it sort of off my own bat, you know, cutting video, cutting tapes at home and all that type of stuff. So when it's like that, it just becomes really hard. You put a lot of effort in and you don't get, I guess, the reward that you probably feel that you should have. And then there came that point, I think I was 25 or 26 years old, and I said, what am I doing? Am I wasting my time? Should I just play NPL and do it? But then the opportunity came again with Brisbane. And I risked again. I went over there. I signed for pittance, pretty much. I had a wife and kids, and signed for, couldn't feed us all. So, but I went and did it because I backed myself, and I knew that if I got the opportunity, that I would make. And I got the opportunity in Brisbane, and once I was in that environment again, I guess I took the bulls by the horn and just went for it.
Your coach was Meron Blyberg, a very extrovert personality. Give us your favourite Meron story.
Oh, there was a lot. Jesus, where do you start? I remember we were playing, I think it was a five-a-side game, and the only way you could score was with a back heel. And you could imagine the frustration. I couldn't back heel anything. So you come to score a goal, instead of just putting it in the back of the net, we'd have to back heel. And unfortunately, all of our games were like that as well. At one point, we'd get to goal and then we'd just pass the ball around and look for the easiest avenue to goal instead of pulling the trigger because of all these games that he invented and that, yeah. So he was a very rare individual.
But he gave you your big opportunity. You were 26 then. And then after a couple of years, you, of course, went to Adelaide United in 2008. You were only with the Reds for one season, but I guess that's where your career really took off.
Yeah, well, Adelaide had qualified for the Champions League, which was, I guess, you know, part of the carrot that got me across there. And, you know, it was a decent squad. I think they struggled. They struggled defensively a lot the year before, but they had a decent squad on paper. So, I was a young coach. Their assistant was a coach that I knew well from the old VPL days, and Phil Stubbins. So to get to work with him, he coached me in a Victorian state team squad at one point. So I liked the way he worked as well. So that was a good draw card as well. And then we went on that, that amazing journey to the Champions League final, where Gamba Saka, Julie slotted five past us. But, you know, it was the first Australian team to make an Asian Champions League final. And it was a different stage there too, because you had to finish first on the group. I remember we had the last game against Chanchun Yatai, and that's, you know, not a place that you sort of want to spend extra time visiting. And around that time, there was a tragic earthquake in China, so the game was delayed another couple of days, and we had to get a point out of that game to top the group and go into the next stage. So I think for the last 15, 20 minutes, we parked on the 18-yard line and just repelling ball after ball and tackle after tackle. And
And we got out of the group stage, and then, you know, sort of everything just opened up for us. We played Bunyakor.
With Rivaldo as well?
With Rivaldo, yeah, and Zico was the coach. And I think he thought that we were going to be easy beats, and he came to Adelaide, and he just opened up. And I think we put three past him, and then we went over there, and we lost 1-0, but it was, you know, we still went through. So, yeah, it was a real... We rode the tidal wave, and I think when you get to any final of a major tournament like that, even we saw Western Sydney Wanderers, you just, you know, they kept riding the wave, and the belief just grows, and it's amazing when you do get that belief, you actually think that you're a lot better than you are. And as a team, we had that mentality as well. You know, we were fighting on both fronts. We were first or second for most of the year at home. We made the A-League final as well. Lost a player in the 27th minute. I think it was Cristiano. Got sent off in a red card. So it was, although we didn't win any, it was a pretty successful season there at Adelaide. And off the back of that, I got the move to Seongnam in South Korea. And that's...
Just before we move on to Seongnam,
yeah.
I just want to ask you, I remember you telling me a while ago when you first arrived in Adelaide and you still had the long hair in those days and the beard, you know, you looked like a bit of a fearsome warrior. And yet the welcome wasn't necessarily friendly. You almost sort of had to prove yourself a little bit amongst the Adelaide playing group, which was pretty well established at the time.
Yeah, well, that it was an interesting dynamic in that group because, you know, a lot of them were from Adelaide, so they saw you as an outsider. A lot of them sort of were there from even the last season of the old NSL. So, you know, you had these, you know, stout South Australians, me being a proud Victorian as well, so that didn't sort of help. And I'm not, I guess I got a pretty strong character, and there were a few strong characters there as well. So, you know, until they sort of got to know me and respected what I did on the field and respected how I trained and how hard I worked, then that all changed as well. And then, like I said to you, the success and the belief that team had was really strong.
Talking of success, 2010 was your standout year as a footballer. You won the AFC Champions League. You won Asian Player of the Year. You were in the K-League Best 11 for Seongnam. You were the Champions League Most Valuable Player. You even scored in the FIFA Club World Cup. That must have been a dream year for you, particularly as you've already outlined, the struggles that you had to go through just to make it as a professional footballer. Did you feel as though that year was your reward?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, and again, when you ride that wave and stuff just happens. So, you know, a lot of that work that I did, I guess early days, you know, I used to, as a 15-year-old, when I was 16 years old, I used to work around the corner from BT Connor Reserve where Preston trained. And we had a couple of players that used to work night shifts, so they couldn't train. So I used to leave my place of work, ride to training, train with them, and then ride back, make up the hours, and then go back and train at night and then ride back home. So, you know, all those extra sessions that I did off my own bat, and all of that stuff, you know, all the sort of work paid off in 2010. I know it happened probably, you know, 15, 16 years before that, but in 2010, it all just came to a head. I was fortunate enough, I guess, to play in a team that again had a lot of self-belief and I had good players, really strong quality players around me to help us achieve something that was pretty special.
How were you received in Korea? I know the fans loved you, but Did you find living there difficult? Obviously, it's a very different culture. I don't know whether you picked up any of the language or not, or whether the food was to your liking. These are all things that, you know, people, when they only see you on the TV playing football, don't sort of fully comprehend that you have to actually immerse yourself in that life as well.
Yeah, and I did. I learned Korean. I started, you know, I could hold a conversation around football, I guess, sort of in the last year or so there. You know, I was given the captaincy there. So a lot of their captains are really strict on the team. You know, some of them can get physical with players that don't put in and the rest of us. So I was a breath of fresh air in that sense. I led by example on the field and what I did off the field as well professionally, you know, how I live my life and that. So they got to see all that side of things as well. So that was different for my team. I think I was the first foreign captain ever in South Korea as well. So it wasn't something that was always there. There were other clubs that had captains, but the actual club captain for the entire season, I was the first one to be named club captain of a Korean side. So that was something different for them, and it was because I did immerse myself in their culture and I respected their culture that I probably got the opportunity to be a captain and a leader at that club.
I just wanted to pick out one specific moment. It's not from the Champions League final. Or from the domestic campaign, but at that FIFA Club World Cup, I know you played against Inter Milan, and you came up against one of your boyhood heroes, Goran Pandev, and you got his shirt after playing against Inter. How special was that moment for you?
Yeah, that was good, because that year as well, he was named Macedonian Player of the Year, and I come runner up to him. So. It was strange. We obviously spoke after the game, and you know, we had a couple of funny moments during the game, and we changed tops and the rest of it. It was at a time where I was very close to playing for the Macedonian national team. So he knew a lot about me, and he knew about what was happening and the rest of it. So it was quite an interesting time.
Well, that leads us nicely on to sort of the international sphere before we resume your club travels. Despite all of this success, the Socceroos, who were under Pimver Bake at the time, continued to ignore you. And as you say, you almost played for Macedonia under Sretsko Katanets. Was it the case that Pim just didn't fancy you as a player?
Yeah, I don't know. A lot of coaches, Graham Arnold, he picked a squad of Australian-based players to, you know, showcase for Pimver Bake, and I wasn't in that squad. And that was at a time where I thought I was playing decent football. It was 2009 when I was at Adelaide, and I thought that season I did okay. So to miss out on that squad was a bit disheartening as well. But again, you know, not every player is every coach's cup of tea, and I guess Arnie, he had no choice, obviously, when he came to Sydney, and I was already there, but he probably wouldn't have spoken me otherwise later on. But yeah, you know, like, I might not be every coach's cup of tea, as we saw with, I guess, Ange later on when I wasn't established Socceroo.
Just on Pimver Bake, and obviously, you know, people listening to this won't know this, but and we know Pim passed away tragically earlier on this year, but you and I were at the Asian Cup in 2019. We were commentating together, and on New Year's Eve, Pimver Bake and his wife invited us out for a dinner, which we all attended. I think people know that I was pretty close with Pim. And I asked you, did you want to go? Because obviously this was... I don't know whether you'd spoken to Pim in the interim, but this was a bit of a narrative, you know, that you didn't like each other necessarily. Was that a bit...
No, I've never spoken to him in my life prior to that. So, yeah, I didn't have a problem. He actually asked me if I could play for Oman because I was struggling defensively, but I said, couldn't.
But, But after that meeting, did you, I don't know whether you at that dinner actually had a conversation about the football, but it seemed to go pretty smoothly.
Yeah, no, it was fine. Look, and again, you can only look forward and you know, if you dwell on the past too much. Obviously, I was disappointed not to get a call up, because I thought that particularly in 2010, I was probably at the peak of my powers, or getting there anyway. So to miss out when you're playing the football that I was sort of playing, then that's disappointing. But like I said, it is what it is. I'm not the first, I'm not the last to miss out on a World Cup. There's been some amazing footballers who haven't gone to World Cups for one reason or another. So that's, you know, it would have been, I guess, the icing on the cake for my football career. But yeah, it's not anything that I dwell on anyway.
You did manage to go to the Asian Cup in 2011 under Holger Osik, who finally called you up, giving you your first cap against Egypt in late 2010. Obviously, everybody knows that Australia lost to Japan in extra time in the final. Was that a difficult pill to swallow after the tournament you'd had?
Yeah, I mean, we conceded one goal throughout the whole tournament. So, you know, to lose to a goal in extra time, which was the second goal that we conceded. You know, you think if you concede two goals in a major tournament, you come pretty close to winning it. So, and we did come pretty close, just not good enough on the day. I think their goalkeeper won man of the match that game. So, yeah, it was disappointing. It would have been, I guess, you know, the success that I had in 2010, and then to follow that up with an Asian Cup win would have been amazing.
So let's return to your club career. After 3 years with Songnam, you went to Salal in Qatar. I know you'd had some interest from European clubs. Crystal Palace, Werder Bremen and Wolfsburg were all mentioned. And I know that the Bundesliga was always your favourite overseas competition as a kid growing up. Why did, in the end, you opt for Qatar? Was Europe...
Well, I didn't. I knocked back two transfer windows of going to Qatar, because I wasn't chasing money. I just went... I was pretty close to getting to Crystal Palace, and I kept pushing for a European move. Unfortunately, when your career takes off at 30, it doesn't always help. So that's just, you know, the career sort of taken off late. I went overseas, I guess, when I look back at it, I went overseas at the right time, probably went to the wrong country, probably didn't have the managerial guidance that I possibly needed. I kept pushing and pushing for that European dream, but then when it sort of didn't come to fruition, I went to Qatar and took the money. I guess I was, you know, the career is only short, so I said, okay, it's time to, you know, stop thinking about your own dreams a little bit and start to think of it financially. Because although we did have success and whatnot in at Songnam, the money wasn't crazy money. It was just, you know, average sort of money. So it wasn't anything too amazing over there. So I had to sort of bite the bullet. I didn't particularly want to go and play in those leagues, but that's just where I ended up, I guess.
At the same time, Mark Bresciano was out there playing for Al Gharafa. Did you used to hang out together?
Yeah. So that was good when Mark came across. He was at Al Jazeera, I think it was.
Al Gharafa.
He was in the UAE before, yeah. and then he came across to Al Gharafa, so we used to spend most days together, myself and Mark. So we developed a really strong friendship, and we knew each other from the Socceroos prior to that. So that was yeah, that was good having him there for that 1.5 years that I was there, and then came back home after that.
Yeah, you rounded out your career with Sydney FC. Only a handful of games. Perhaps fittingly enough, your last ever game was in your native Melbourne, a 2-1 playoff defeat to Victory. You find it a bit strange that your lengthy career, you never play for either of the Melbourne clubs during the A-League era.
Yeah, I do. I do find it strange. But coaches have their own player types, I guess. And with the A-League, with the salary caps and with, you know, all that type of stuff, you know, there's a limit on numbers that you can sign, and it just limits a lot of the clubs to signing maybe players like myself. So, for me, I didn't get to play in Melbourne in front of my family and that, but it is what it is. I still had a pretty good career. I made a good fist of it, and I did the best. I think I did the best with what I had. I wasn't the most talented or gifted footballer, but I don't think there's a time any game that I played, and this is going back as a junior as well, that I didn't walk off the field, having said that I've left everything out there. So whether that's enough for some people or not, I don't know. I don't particularly care. But I always knew that I gave my best, and if my best was good, it wasn't.
I just want to finish off with one memory from your playing career. You played a derby game for Sydney against the Wanderers and became rather infamous for berating one of your own teammates for helping the opposition. I think that sort of summed up your career in a nutshell, that little 5-second that little incident.
Yeah, look, that was my goalkeeper, and again, it's because the league is how it is, and you know, a lot of guys have played at teams with each other, so you can't, you know, it's a derby game, west against the east of Sydney, and you know, and then one of their players goes down for a cramp, and our player goes to help him, you know. So that you know, when I was on the field, it was winning was everything. Even at training, if I lost the game at training, you couldn't talk to me. I was upset. So helping the opposition doesn't sit well with me. You know, so if they had won that game, big deal if you helped him with a cramp. Who cares? You know, like it doesn't sit well with me, and I guess probably an overreaction on my behalf, but that's me. I don't I wear my heart on my sleeve, and that's the reaction that I had at that time. And I guess if I didn't have that reaction, it probably wouldn't have the game might have been a different game, I guess. In that game, I caused a bit of controversy. There was a bit of, you know, there was a corner that I remember, and I was just running around in circles getting bumped, and they lost concentration. We ended up scoring from the corner. So, I had to ruffle a few feathers. From memory, we were 2-0 down. So, to try and get a reaction from them and try and lift our boys. So, if that's the way of doing it, that's the way I can influence a game, then I'll influence it that way.
I wonder, Sasha, if you've taken that philosophy into your coaching career. You finished playing in 2014, and you're now back involved in the game as coach of Dandenong City. Mm-hmm. What sort of a coach are you? Are you a ranter and a raver, or are you more the philosophical type on the sideline?
No, I coach the team from the side, so I'm not one that sits down and watches. And so I do tend to move up and down the side of the pitch and try to get players into position and all of that. During the week, I'm more patient and more philosophical, but on game day, I try and help help the players as much as I can from the side. So that's sort of my style. I don't just sit back and wait for stuff. I guess it's hard. You don't get a lot of time to work with the players. Some of the players, like myself, like when I was playing in the other, you know, you come home, you're tired, you've got to go to training. So you don't get the extra time and the extra work that you need to get them where you need them. So you need to try and help them on match day as much as you can, I think, particularly when you bring in a lot of new faces and you're trying to change the playing style a little bit and the rest of it. So you do need to, I find that you do. I find when I sit back, the players tend to lose a bit of concentration and tend to want to do what comes to them probably a little bit more naturally rather than what we want as a coaching staff and myself, you know, what I want the team to do. So I try to be a little bit more vocal in the sidelines and I am up and down and involved in the game.
Yeah, so I was just saying that, I'm more of a, up and down. I try and if I do go quiet during the game, I find that the team loses a bit of concentration and start sort of going back to sort of older habits that they've, you know, potentially played like that in the past and trying to instill my style of play. So I sort of need to stay on top of them in that regard. So that's why I prefer to be sort of up and down the sideline and barking instructions rather than sitting back and just watching the play.
And is this the first step to what could potentially be a coaching career in the A-League? Is that your ultimate ambition?
Yeah, look, yeah, I hope so. A-League or overseas. I had a joke with my brother. I said, if my coaching career takes as long to establish as my playing career, I said, I'll win a trophy at about 70. So, patience is a virtue, they say. But, I'd like my coaching career all going well to get there a little bit quicker than my playing career. So let's see what happens. It's a funny game, coaching. You think sometimes that you've got everything under wraps and under cover, and then something new pops out. So I'm enjoying the challenge at the moment. I'm enjoying coaching. So I think I do have something to offer. I debuted a 16-year-old kid that I think's got a heap of talent. He was playing under 16s last year, and I asked him to come and train. And I gave him a senior contract, and he had a part in 4 of the 5 games that we played so far before the season got suspended. But seeing him improve and seeing him develop, it was a proud moment when I gave him his debut and I put him for the first time. It was a proud moment for me. So that was, and I hope to have many more and start, I guess, many more careers in Australia like that.
Well, Sasha, I'm sure whatever transpires with your coaching career, you will give it 100%. And if you don't succeed, it won't be for the want of trying, just like it was with your playing days. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us today. Really appreciate it, mate.
Not a problem, Simon. Anytime, mate.
And that is our Fox Sports Football podcast for today. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be back next week, hopefully, with another special guest. See you then.